Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at Facebook.com/RadioCafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Tsultrim Gyatso of the Tibetan Ecology Foundation. I'm happy now to welcome to the program Nate Downey. He's the author of the book Harvest the Rain, How to Enrich Your Life by Seeing Every Storm as a Resource. And he is the president of Santa Fe Permaculture. He will be teaching a class for the Climate Masters program this Thursday, the 31st of March. And we'll give more information about all of that later. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. I am such a huge fan, and it's an honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Harvesting the rain. Okay, average person, never done it, rain barrels. Goes far beyond rain barrels.
It does, and in fact, I kind of jab a little bit at rain barrels because I've been doing this long enough to see a lot of people who use rain barrels for a season or two, and then they decide that they really don't work. And in fact, they can work in certain situations, and I have one client who very faithfully moves her sump pump from one rain barrel to another, and she gets her water out of it. But more often than not, people use buckets or they try to use gravity, and what happens is on 1,000 square feet of rain, the average 50-gallon rain barrel.
So you mean 1,000 square feet of rain, meaning like
I'm sorry, did
your
I say
roof
a
is 1,000 square feet.
Feet of roof. Thank you. In an average year in Santa Fe, that will overflow an average rain barrel 130 times.
Right.
So it's not really doing as much as it could. It might be better just to look at the water coming off your roof and direct it straight to some bushes or some trees or some, you know, edible plants, rather than first put it in a rain barrel that's just going to overflow anyway.
So that's done through the use of gutters, pretty much?
Gutters and canales. Of course, we have a lot of flat roofs where you don't typically connect a gutter. Although you can, you don't typically connect a gutter to a flat and a downspout to a flat roof. It comes shooting off of these canales, which it does pose problems for capturing that, because sometimes the water shoots far away from the house, and sometimes it dribbles back toward the house, and sometimes the wind blows and it blows left or right. But what we do is we create these things that just look like patches of gravel on the surface of the soil, but underneath is basically a funnel that goes into a little drain box, and from that drain box a pipe can then run anywhere on your property, you know, downslope, into, say, a cistern or into a pumice wick, which is a neat system where you basically make a sponge underground where you plant on either side of the pumice. And these days there's actually a company, a Santa Fe-based company, that built a factory down in Albuquerque that is using recycled glass instead of pumice. So I'm very excited about that. They can basically heat up glass from the landfill that would normally, you know, be sitting there with nothing really, it's hard to find a market for it, and they turn it into this product that can really become a sponge underground.
One thing that I'm noticing as I read your book is that low-tech is kind of the way to go, and I think that we have a mythology in our culture which is beginning to fall apart that brilliant new high-tech solutions will save us, save the planet. But When we look at what you're doing with rainwater harvesting, it's very simple things like directing the water through shaping the earth and wicks, things like that.
Yeah, I call it the modern American macho mentality that we kind of try to get away from, because we do have this tendency in our culture to build these large dams and to create these complicated systems, but it really doesn't have to be that way, and for the average homeowner it's much too expensive to go that route. So instead, we look at gravity, and we look at these basic principles of nature that say, okay, how can I easily get water to the root systems of a plant? There's these very simple rock tubes that go into the ground that just divert water down to the root system of a plant with gravity and with a little bit of forethought in the beginning when you first start to do your planting. And then you can basically forget about these things and let nature do the work.
Which is a really nice way of thinking about gardening, is to do the least amount of work possible.
Yeah, that's very big also and very important in our culture because we do not, you know, have time to get everything that we have to get done during the day and then come back and tend our garden. So as much as what we can do that is low maintenance is very helpful for people. And so one of those things is called sheet mulching, where you put down a layer of cardboard, a layer of manure, and straw. And basically what you've done is created a mulch that's compost. It's got the carbon and the nitrogen that you need for compost, and you just let that digest. And in the spring, this time of year, you spread that straw and that manure out of the way, and the cardboard will have decayed, and you can plant your plants right in there. And then you have the mulch doing all sorts of things for you. It retains water in the soil. It prevents wind damage. It builds the soil with that compost, essentially, and prevents weeds. And so
it prevents weeds.
Well, the mulch will. The one weed that you will get out of that kind of system is an annual from the straw, typically. And so that rye or wheat or whatever comes up from the straw can be easily pulled in that first year. And as long as you get it before it goes to seed, you typically don't have problems. And so, yeah, it becomes a weed barrier as it builds your soil, as it retains moisture, as it prevents wind damage. And
building soil is a theme here in New Mexico where we've got this very hard and sometimes not very friendly soil.
Yeah, one of the first things we do in landscape design, in permaculture landscape design, is to determine our pathways so that we don't compact the soil. That's critical. If we don't know where to send people and where people should be walking, they'll just walk everywhere and stomp all over the place, and you'll end up with a lifeless dirt, an inert material that won't provide any nutrients for whatever you plant. So the first thing is to determine your pathways. The next thing is to determine where that water will go, whether it's coming off of a slope, off of a driveway, off of a patio, or off of a roof.
We're talking to Nate Downey about harvesting the rain. So how do you think about the relationship between small scale, your yard? Let's say you live in a tiny little place as I do, which has a little front yard, little backyard. Okay. The medium scale, maybe, which is your watershed, the Santa Fe watershed. And then the large scale, starting to think about planetary and global issues. How do you think about them separately and together?
Right. So it's all connected. And so I look at it that everybody has an opportunity wherever they live to slow the water coming off of their roof. And that's actually very important for the local watershed and for the planet as a whole. If you can take the responsibility so that the water that's coming off your roof, which is actually an unnatural situation, and before your house was there, rain and snow would come and it would hit the ground and typically soak in locally. But because it's coming off at very rapid speeds all at one place in large quantities, it takes a lot of the existing soil or dirt with it. And when it takes that with it, that ends up down in the Rio Grande watershed, or first the Santa Fe River, and actually clogs up the river system so that it makes it difficult for wildlife to survive. So one of the big things one can do to help their local watershed is right definitely in their backyard with the water coming off their roof. And of course, once we improve our local watersheds at the community level, then we can say that we're really helping the planet as a whole, because then we're helping with, you know, migratory birds, and the migratory birds, you know, help the local farmers because they'll be creating more biodiversity in the bioregion. And then when we have a healthier food shed, we're helping the planet because we're not having to import food from elsewhere. So it's definitely all connected.
You talk about active and passive water harvesting. What do those two terms mean?
Okay, the passive water harvesting is mostly what we've been talking about today. That's storing water in the soil. Active water harvesting is storing water typically in a cistern or a tank that is then pumped out. So you can also apply active water harvesting to a gravity situation where you don't have a pump. But the active part is typically describing that hydraulic lift of a pump where you do have parts that can break down and you need to pump the water into typically a pressure tank, which then goes into a drip irrigation system, which so many of us have around town, and many people are familiar with a drip irrigation, which is a great way to water plants, but it does add another level of complexity that some people sort of are not willing to go to. But ultimately, the active water harvesting systems are the best, because then you can take the water when you want it and put it where you want it in the most efficient and productive manner. Whereas, you know, storing water in the soil is much less expensive, but it gives you less flexibility as to where you can use that water.
So if you've got a big rainstorm in the afternoon and it does that every day for a week, as it sometimes does in the summer, then you can store that water and then water during the cool hours so that you don't have so much evaporation, for example.
That's right. And you can wait, you know, several days or several weeks to use up that water and extend that rain, you know, that monsoon season far into your season, into your growing season. And so there's a lot more flexibility with active water harvesting. But I do end up talking a fair amount of people out of it, because an underground cistern can be very expensive. Now, we do have the option in some cases here of going with an above-ground cistern, but there are problems there, especially when we have winters like we had last winter, where pipes froze all over town. And so typically my favorite kind of cistern is a partially buried cistern. It's less expensive because you don't have to dig a huge hole to put an entire tank underground, but it's also frost-free. It's frost-resistant. And so if you dig your cistern down, so it's 3 feet, 2.5 feet down below the surface of the earth, that connection where the pipe comes out, where the water's going to come out, will be below the frost line, and you won't have big freezing problems.
And then the top part, do people paint it black or dark brown?
Well, it's
so it absorbs the sun?
Yes, it's helpful, definitely, to have a opaque cistern. And sometimes many of them come black or dark green. Sometimes people paint them because they don't really like that industrial look of the tank. But one of the best things to do really is to plant plants in front of it, or to set up a trellis so that vines can grow up essentially on the tank and allows it to disappear and makes it a much more visually appealing situation in your backyard.
Now, Nate, you're a New York City boy. You grew up on the 7th floor of an apartment building. How did you get into all of this?
Yeah, well, my grandmother was a big influence on me. She taught me how to compost and the importance of protecting your watershed, actually. And I knew at an early age, after spending some time with her in Connecticut and then going to a summer camp in Vermont, that I wasn't going to be a city boy when I grew up. And I came out to St. John's, and I was always kind of an environmentalist and a little bit more active on the political side of things. And when I heard about this permaculture business, it sounded very appealing to me, because it said to me, look, you can get very sustainable in your own backyard, and you can kind of, in a sense, subvert the political process without having to deal with all these regulations and people and problems in the world, and you can just produce your own food and energy locally. And that was very appealing. But then once I started to get to doing it, I realized that there were agencies and laws that got in the way. And so I've kind of come full circle and have been, again, sort of very politically active so that we can make sure laws are changed so that it makes the permaculture a little bit easier for people to do.
What kind of laws get in the way of, well, first of all, what is permaculture, and sure, then what are the laws surrounding it?
Permaculture is a system of design that uses natural principles for the production of food and energy locally. So there are many ways you can apply that. In fact, you can apply permaculture design principles to your garden or your business or a bureaucracy or a political campaign. My favorite example is synergy, where every element in the system performs more than one function. So even a cistern can perform a number of functions. It's holding water so that you can use it later, but as I mentioned before, it's holding water so that you're not polluting the watershed. As you referred to, it can also be a heat sink so that when the sun comes in and soaks into that cistern during the day. Heat can come out at night and make whatever you plant in front of it have a longer growing season. So every element in the system should have more than one function, and you should look at all of the elements that you're putting into your system as how can we make that happen?
I think of Patricia Johansson, whom we had on last year, who's an artist who made a sewage treatment plant, which wasn't a plant at all. It was plants. It was a wetlands.
Great.
And everything that went into it was sewage, and what came out was wildlife, bird habitat, sanctuary, clean water, water for the vineyards across the street. And on some level, that's a beautiful example of what you're saying.
Yeah, I talk about wetlands in my book, and I'm a big fan of wetlands. One of the things that I've done a lot of is use gray water, which, in fact, it's a great example of how in the beginning when I was getting started in permaculture, the state of New Mexico considered gray water and black water the same. Now, gray water is everything but your toilet and your kitchen sink and your dishwasher. So the wastewater that comes out of your house, such as your washing machine, such as from your bathtub and your bathroom sinks, if you divert that to your landscape, well, back in the beginning of my experience with permaculture, you couldn't do that without spending quite a lot of money. So a bunch of us got together and showed up at the state legislature, and we got Mimi Stewart to help us out. And lo and behold, within 1 year, we changed the gray water law so that you could, as long as you separate out that toilet water and that kitchen sink and the dishwasher, and you separate that and keep that as black water, you can take your gray water and run it out into basically a swale or a trench filled with mulch and allow nature to filter that and allow the roots of plants to use it and become very nutrient-rich, happy little oasis on your property.
One of the things that I think a lot of people are curious about is scale, because the question of, for example, we talked with Eric Herm, the farmer, about this not too long ago, how much land it takes to feed a person. And the number keeps getting smaller as new techniques come in, people doing intensive gardening in little plastic hoop houses and stuff like that. Where water conservation and water harvesting is concerned, what's the lower limit? I mean, what is just too small to even think about?
Oh, there's no lower limit. The quick mathematics that it's important for people to understand is 1,000 square feet of roof produces 7,500 gallons of water in an average year in Santa Fe, if you take that average as being 12 inches per year. That 7,500 gallons is quite a bit of water. Now, people know that their water bills, you'll look at that, and actually it might not even take care of the water use inside the house for some people. But as we evolve and as we sometimes get more politically active too, we can begin to change the way we build houses. Perhaps in the future we won't have flush toilets. We'll be going to composting toilets. That would reduce a lot of the waste that we have in our houses. But if, in my experience, using the water that comes off the roof or off of a driveway or off of a slope and putting that into especially edible plants, we can then reduce the amount of land that the farmer needs for us to provide our own food. And it's very interesting. If you apply permaculture principles, you can become very, very productive per acre on a piece of property. If you integrate perennial plants into your landscape and of course, we want it to be beautiful and our landscapes to be aesthetically pleasing places, and not everybody wants to have a farm in their backyard. But it's quite easy to do that if you integrate flowering plants and edible plants. And sometimes you need to change your aesthetic a little bit so that you actually can get a sense that that rhubarb leaf is actually gorgeous, and it is. And then you integrate that with some of the traditional flowering perennials and realize that those flowering perennials bring in beneficial insects that then help the overall productivity of your backyard.
Do you harvest water that ends up being drinking water? Are people doing that around here?
A lot of people do that, say, on Row Mesa and in other places where the water table is just very far away. The Good Water Company and other companies have these systems that you can buy that, with a couple of filters that take out the sort of particulate and then run the water that's been filtered into these tubes filled with that have a UV, basically sunlight going through the middle of them, you can burn out anything that might make you sick. And so it's actually pretty easy to do.
It sounds pretty low tech, all things considered.
Well, you know, and in Australia and New Zealand, they don't even bother with the UV lights. My wife and I went down to New Zealand for our honeymoon, and we had this wonderful meal. All the food was produced locally, this farm, and these friends of ours took us around, and we just had this great time, and they showed us where all the food that we're going to have that night would come from. And then we had the food, and we drank pitchers of water, and then we were heading out to our place where we were going to stay for the night. And I asked the guy, well, you know, what kind of filtration system do you have in your cistern? And he said, well, it's nothing much more than a pantyhose.
Good heavens. So
they just, don't get
just
sick.
Just a little nylon mesh, and that was their filtration system.
Yeah, he looked at me quizzically when I talked about the UV lights, and he didn't even know what I was talking about. So, you know, and that's a first world country. I mean, we weren't, you know, in some primitive community there. They you know, drive cars and go to work and drink water right out of their cistern. And maybe they've grown up there, so their stomachs are a little tougher. But you never hear of people going to New Zealand and, you know, getting, you know, dysentery or some, you know, terrible disease.
Yeah, you didn't get horrible parasites from
it? No.
Yeah.
And so it's sometimes a little bit of a perception, and sometimes the regulatory agencies are, I wouldn't want to say paranoid, but they have a job to do, and they want to make sure nobody ever gets sick. And so we end up with a little bit more technology than we might need, you know, sort of an average situation.
Well, our legal system seems to be based on the notion that if one bad thing happens to one person ever, then there needs to be a law to make sure that one thing never happens again.
Right.
No matter what the hardship of implementing that law is for everybody else.
Yeah, and that can definitely get in the way of our productivity.
What are some of the things that you've done in your own home?
Okay, well, we do have a 10,000-gallon cistern underground, and we do have a gray water system that pretty much goes to one cottonwood tree, which we are eventually going to be able to replace a big Siberian elm tree next to it, which, as many people know, the Siberian elm tree is basically a weed that you're not allowed to plant in the state of New Mexico anymore. It gets into septic systems, it gets into the sewer systems of the city, and it gets into gardens, and it's a really invasive species. So, but we like the shade that the Siberian elm tree is creating, and so we didn't want to chop it down. We want to apply this permaculture principle called succession. So maybe in about 5, 10, 15 years at the most, we will cut down that Siberian elm tree because the gray water from our bathtub is coming to this cottonwood, this Rio Grande cottonwood tree, which actually does need a fair amount of water. But when it gets going and when it's providing that kind of shade, it'll actually do better than even the Siberian elm tree in terms of providing shade. We have edible gardens. We integrate fruit trees and berry bushes and annual vegetables. We have chickens that produce eggs and manure for our compost, which is a big deal for us as well. We have a bunny that also produces compost and that can eat down weeds. We have a little bunny tractor that we sometimes move around if the weeds get bad, so the bunny can get a little new perspective on life from a different angle in the garden. But he's sort of trapped in there in his little bunny tractor, and he eats down the grasses and such that are coming up where we don't want them to. We have a bean teepee where the beans grow up, and we use vertical space so that the beans grow up into a teepee and the kids can play in that teepee. And
so the shape of the teepee is made of the bean plants.
Right. And so you have these posts that all come together in a conical shape, and up top they meet. And then we plant beans around it every year, and they grow up, and it becomes a nice little playhouse for the kids. Bean teepees are also good for people who don't have kids who want to grow lettuces in the heat of the summer.
Right.
And sometimes it gets just too hot for your lettuce and cold crops. So that you have a bean teepee, you can get your species that prefer a little bit of shade in the middle of summer going pretty nicely in that kind of situation. And ultimately, as you harvest the beans and as the beans dry out, those cold crops can actually have a nice little microclimate where their season is extended because of the protection that that teepee provides.
We're talking to Nate Downey, author of the book Harvest the Rain. The daunting thing as you're talking is all the knowledge that it takes to get from where I am, let's say, to where you are, which of course you've been doing over the over 20 years that you've lived here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. How do people start? How do you encourage people to just take a first step?
Well, the first thing that everybody should understand is that permaculture is nothing new. What it really is intuition and common sense. And some of these little riffs that I've been going off on today are some of the same things that I learned in that first permaculture class that I took back in 1992. And once you get the basic principles down, the details are pretty easy to manipulate. So, although, yes, I have had a lot of experience, and there are certain things that I do now that I wouldn't have done before, the main thing is that people should just start trying to do this. They shouldn't start on some huge, overwhelming project that's going to discourage them if it doesn't work out. One of the permaculture principles is what we call use incremental design, and you start small.
But so maybe get water to one tree.
Exactly. And in my book, I have this whole section called gradual greening, where you just take 10 minutes a day. And if
you call it get rich slow. I love that.
Yeah. And so, yeah, over the course of 30 years, if you take 10 minutes a day and you add 10 minutes every year, so in the second year you're doing 20 minutes a day for the backyard or for the planet, however you want to define it. And in the third year you're doing half an hour a day. And so if you add that over a 30-year period, you'll be applying the same amount of time that the average American applies to their watching their screen, their television, or their iPhone for a little bit over 4 hours a day. You'll be taking that time and applying it to doing something sustainable in your community or in your backyard.
Heck, you can take it right off of Facebook, most people.
Yeah, yeah
that,
absolutely.
That amount of time, and it's just a question of getting started, and your book is a wonderful way. It's called Harvest the Rain, How to Enrich Your Life by Seeing Every Storm as a Resource. And I have to say that one of the underlying messages of this is this whole question of if the system around us begins to collapse, what's our security? And this is one of the ways to have at least something resembling water security.
Yeah, and then it's very related to food security. And I know we've been talking about food a lot today, and it's so important for people to realize that connection. It's not just about water, that if you can reduce your use locally and leave more water for the farmers, we'll all be better off. And I guess I've been worried about the sort of situation of our society for a really long time, and we still are hanging in there, and I think we'll be hanging in there for a while. But the more people who can kind of have a sense of what to do when it really gets bad, the more and more people we have moving toward that, the better off we'll be should things start to crumble.
Nate Downey, you'll be teaching a class on Thursday, the 31st of March, for the Climate Masters program. People can come to it, but they have to call you in order to register and find out where it is and all of that.
Yeah, they can email me at nate@sfpermaculture.com. They can call me at 690-7939. My website is sfpermaculture.com or harvesttherain.com. You just Google me. And
Nate Downey, that's easy enough.
Yeah.
Nate Downey, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so very much.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Sultrim Gyatso. He is founder of the Tibetan Ecology Foundation. He made a film called Blood of the Earth, Colorado River, and he is taking people on environmental tours to Tibet. And also this Saturday, the 2nd of April, Tsultrim Gyatso will be speaking at the Travel Bug bookstore at 5 in the afternoon right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So what kind of environmental problems, what kind of environmental situations are you looking at in Tibet?
We are looking at several different kinds of them. Most likely glaciers and water, fresh water issues. Tibet is a 7 major river sources of Asia that impact to, I will say, more than 30% of the world population is depends on rivers originate from Tibetan Plateau. And it's also, you know, connect to the global warming. It's Tibet is all of the glaciers and snow mountains are disappearing.
So you've got problems that are caused by glaciers melting, snowpack melting, most likely as a direct result of climate change.
Exactly. And then at the end, there is a man-made, particularly local issues are like we are going to have a lot of dams on the Yangtze River and Mekong River, in where the southeast east of Tibetan Plateau. I have some information that I have know that they are going to have 12 dams. And one of the smallest dam will be like a Glen Dam on Colorado River. That's a huge. That would be the smallest one.
Right, right. So you've got snow melt and glacier melt. You've got dams that are in the process of being built or planned to be built. And you are taking people to look at this. Sounds like things that you can't do anything about.
Yeah, there's nothing really can do except really high authorities of Chinese government and probably some of the international environmental groups will be give a good impact on Chinese policymakers, decision makers. That will be much more good thing that if we can do something about it. And then there's, a lot of minings happening, and then there's a lot of environmental degradations. For example, like grass are too dry, grass roots are too dry and cracked down. And also some of, you know, Tibetan Plateau is like really a plateau, so it has lots of wind. And then it's blew up all of the grassroots out, and then plus minings and constructions and new, you know, modern thing going on. So it's all required to dig down to the earth. So then under the grassroots, you have a lot of desert, you know, like sand, literally sand. And there are where the first curve, near to the first curve of the Yellow River, lot of huge, like 2-3 counties are turning into a literally desert. So some of the things are that interest for me is to help, how can I help for those? And then we came up with the idea of planting tree tours, like, you know, people from here that join our eco tours and go there and to plant trees.
So ecotourism as actually a way of helping to restore the landscape in certain parts of Tibet, especially near the rivers?
Not exactly around the river bank, but very close to the first yellow curve of the Yellow River. And it's really famous for being dry and being desert now. Just it happened last 20 years. Before that, that is a place where you can see lots of wildlife animals, like gazelles, blue sheep.
And those aren't there anymore?
No more anymore, nothing there. They are much more moved towards to Himalaya and Changtang area, which is also a really, really beautiful place to view wildlife.
So you are hoping to take people, or you are taking people, on these eco tours, what will they do? They have the opportunity to see the landscape, learn about the landscape, plant trees.
Uh-huh. And also, my plan is to organize people and go there, see those animals, also documenting them. Either you can document rivers, a plant, because Tibetan Plateau is a very high elevation, there are certain plants only grows there. So I want volunteers, want to be to document those, taking pictures, maybe 1,000 to 2,000 words of articles, and we are going to archive those, because a lot of information that you can see from Chinese sources, there is a lot of things. Oh, we have about we have about 470 birds and thousand of plant, different kinds of plants, but they are not accessible. So I'm going to make people encourage, help us to archive them, document them. Glaciers, rivers, or lifestyle even, you know, how the environment impacting to the Tibetan people. For example, we are nomadic life. Most of them are nomadic life. Now, if you go to nomadic town, most likely you will see motorbikes than horses.
Right.
So that's kind of change that we can see. And I hate to say this, but this is probably will be the last chance to see the nature of Tibet.
Before it's completely changed and industrialized.
Now, yeah, industrialized is coming. You know, railway is connected to Tibet. Now it's going to connect to some other places too. But however, the mining is happening, rivers are damming, global is changing, and their lifestyle is changing. Probably this will be the last chance to see Tibet.
We're talking to Tsultrim Gyatso. So you are looking for Americans or Europeans, anybody who wants to go, I mean anybody at all who wants to go on this trip to Tibet. When do you go?
There are best times, May, April. May will be very good to see the rivers and doing any other thing excepting the tree planting tour. Tree planting tour has to be planted and go before the the trees having borne the
the buds.
Yeah, the little buds are coming out. After that, you cannot plant trees.
Right.
Other tours, visiting wildlife and birds and rivers, you can do much more. I will recommend in summer, but tree planting tour has to be before about first week of April.
First week of April.
Yeah, and it's once a year.
It's once a year. Now, when people go on these tours, do they get to see cities and monasteries and things like that?
Yeah, of course. Full of monasteries are all over in Tibet. It's doesn't matter you're taking a bird or anything. Almost every town you go, you will see a monastery. And probably every village that has some monastery by distance or very close to, it's because we are, spiritual people. And of course, you can see holy sites, Potala Palace and Chokhon Temple and some other very famous Buddhist sect, holy monasteries.
Now, you grew up in Tibet and you were actually a monk for a while.
Yes, I was probably about 11 to 12 years. I'm not sure because when I went to monastery, I was too young to remember that. However, I have experience of being a Tibetan Buddhist monk in Tibet. The monastery called Labrang Monastery. We have about 2,500 monks still.
And they are still practicing Tibetan Buddhism?
Yes, they still practice what the regular they have to do, study or philosophy debating or all of that ritual classes and stuff like that.
Now, you are also working with Tibetan travel companies, travel agencies.
Yes. The reason that we are doing this Tibet Eco Tour is to fundraising for Tibetan Ecology Foundation's programs, projects that we do in Tibet. And then, you know, I feel like, you know, to have a profitable and give people have some sort of, you know, they feel like their spending money is for worthwhile, for something. That's the best way to fundraising. I don't think it's just to go to ask them, hey, I'm doing this, give me money. So another thing is that tour will support the local Tibetan businesses in Tibet. So we are patronizing Tibetan-owned hotels, restaurants, and transportations, and travel agents.
And you're also doing, as part of the eco tour, some river cleanup.
Yes, exactly. You know, I've been there for a long time. I was grew up in Amdo, and I lived in Lhasa for the last 6 years. So, and then at that time, you know, I have taken photos here.
There's some amazing before and after photographs, which we would show people on the radio if we could.
Right. But those rivers, I took those photos. You know, rivers are has to be cleaned up. This river is a tributary of Dharmaputra River. And then all of these cities or villages or people don't really have a culture of to concept of to clean up the rivers or recycling culture, nothing like that. So we wanted to take tour groups and to show either both ways, you know, go to see them or to see clean up the rivers.
So what are your goals for the Tibetan Ecology Foundation?
The goal of Tibet Ecology Foundation, I wanted to promote Tibet ecology environment because it's really, really in danger now, you know, sense of very emergency. Because once all of these industrial come into Tibet, Tibet will be no longer same as before. So we wanted to promote Tibet. And we want another thing is we do education materials. We wanted to do that Tibetans can access Tibetan language, their own language. They can understand global and the planet, because there's not really much Tibetan language environmental materials in Tibet.
Right, right. Now you made this film about the Colorado River called Blood of the Earth. And that has actually been translated with Tibetan subtitles.
Yes, totally. It's a Tibetan subtitle. It's kind of, you know, these days you can do DVD stuff that you can have subtitle or no subtitle.
Right.
But also, I hired a Tibetan local TV company that to voice over. And so now the DVD has the voiceover in an audio track, and also you can have Tibetan subtitles.
So all of this is happening. You're based here in Santa Fe. The tours to Tibet go basically whenever there are enough people to go on them?
I have made certain date for birds watching tours, and also planting tour, of course, that's very important. And also wildlife in Changtang area, which is north of Tibet, has lots of wild yaks and Tibetan antelope, which is famous for being well-known Tibet wildlife. And all of that has to be certain date. And I have all of those in website. What days are the best days for viewing wildlife, birds, or planting trees.
And the website is TibetanEcology.org. You can also go to treesfortibet.com. Both of those are websites that will tell you more about these
yes,
tours.
Yes, exactly. TreesfortTibet.com, a guy that he's also from East Tibet, and he lives in UK, and he's a father and him to... both together, they're really concerned about their grassland. Of course, I mean, grass is turning into desert. So he's over there, and he's sometimes singing and have some concerts and sell the tickets and try to do some fundraising for it. And then I suggest them, why don't you just take a tour, plant trees? And also possibly, you know, people will be interested to help you. And then that's why we are kind of helping each other to doing this tree planting tour.
Tsultrim Gyatso is founder of the Tibetan Ecology Foundation. Once again, they're on the web at TibetanEcology.org. He's a filmmaker, and the other website is treesfortibet.com. Now, do you ever take school groups over to do tree planting and ecological tours and things like that?
One of my plan is I really, really like these school kids, American school kids that can go to Tibet, see Tibet, and planting trees. Because, you know, they are going to have fun. They are going to have see the cities, see the different people and landscape. And plus, they are going to plant tree 1 or 2 days. And then, you know, next day you get in hotel and you don't really, they will feel it's a hard work.
It's not going to be
two weeks
of labor.
No, it's not like that. It's you go there and probably 5 days you see around, you know, mountains and wildlife and stuff. And also we organize specialist, one of my friend who is a Canadian, he's a biologist and he studied Tibet biology and he got a PhD from studying Tibet ecology. And he's going to willing to talk to people about ecology, about Tibetan wildlife and stuff. So I really wanted to encourage these young American students go there planting trees and, you know, talk to people, local people and international experts to see, you know, talk about this wildlife.
Is there a phone number at which people can reach you?
Yes. My phone number is 847-772-1430.
Say that again. 847?
847-772-1430.
And you're going to be speaking at the Travel Bug Bookstore.
Yes. Travel Bug Bookstore, they organize really good slideshows and travel awareness, and they give you free place to present your presentation. So I'm really thankful for them to be there and to do my slideshow. And of course, I'm going to talk about environment and also going to talk about how you get there, what you have to concern, what kind of culture barrier, what kind of travel service I do, and stuff like that.
And that's, once again, Saturday, the 2nd of April at 5 o'clock in the afternoon at the Travel Bug here in Santa Fe.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Tsultrim Gyatso, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
All right. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.